Session number 13520, reel number 1.
Mr. Morgan, reel 1.
Whereabouts were you born, please?
I was born in London in 1911.
Which part of London?
In Chelsea.
What did your father do for a living?
My father was a solicitor.
Where did you have your education?
I went to Winchester, in common with most of my family, and to New College, Oxford.
Which year did you graduate from New College?
I graduated in 1932.
And then I joined
John Murray, the publishers, as a trainee, and subsequently, after about a year, became interested in educational publishing, and was lucky enough in 1934 to get into Edward Arnold as an educational editor, and I stayed there until 1939, and then for the war was away, of course, and then rejoined them in 1945.
What was your attitude towards the developing European crisis in the latter part of the 30s?
Well, that's easily explained, that a number of tours, mainly in France, in 36 and 37 had made me, well, first of all in Germany in 34, at the time that Hitler had just come to power, and subsequently in France in 36 and 37, convinced me that the war was extremely likely. And in 38 I made an abortive attempt to join the TA in Duke of York's in Chelsea, which didn't come to anything. No, I beg your pardon, in 37. And then in 38, in February 38, I joined the Queen Victoria Rifles, which was the territorial battalion of the 60th, which was my mother's family regiment, which gave my relations great pleasure, and thoroughly enjoyed myself.
What was your attitude towards the policy of the British government towards Hitler?
I think really in an extreme desire to avoid a war, and a hope beyond hope that what was really self-evident was not in fact going to take place, and that I was remember, I think it must have been in the later part of 1938, I came across a German magazine about aircraft, and that was my first introduction to parachute troops. And I think a study of the history of the First World War and of the German army in general led me really to think that the thing was inevitable. And of course, by the beginning of 1939, it was almost obviously so.
What kind of military training did you have in the QVR before the war?
It was really very good. It was mainly in man management, because there was virtually no equipment. And I was unfortunately seriously ill in the winter of 1938, which led Colonel Coombe, the commanding officer of the QVR, to demote me, if you like, from the 1st Battalion to the newly being formed 2nd Battalion. And that had even less equipment. But what we really were able... Actually, one of the things that happened was that one drew quite heavily on OTC experience of the 20s. One had very little instruction in training, but basically what one learned, I think, was man management, and that was particularly useful when conscripts came along on the outbreak of war. But it is difficult to over-exaggerate the paucity of the equipment that we had.
What in particular did you learn about man management?
Well, really, how to operate in a position which was quite different from that which a civilian had, namely by discussion or encouragement in the form of office man management to a form of discipline, if you like, which in those days was even more than it is at present, a matter of instruction which was accepted without questioning, and that the senior officers in the QVR were particularly good at instructing us, just straight out of City Street, how to behave to non-commissioned ranks and ordinary riflemen. And that was of great assistance, and particularly of assistance later on when I came to be in a position of command over other nationalities in a small way.
Were most of the riflemen from London?
Yes, and well-educated at that, particularly in the 2nd Battalion, which was from the word go formed as a motorcycle battalion, and very sensibly drew on the motorcycling fraternity in the country. They were all, well, practically all, expert riders when they arrived.
What happened to you when war was declared? Did you hear the war declaration?
I was called up, if I remember, about 2 days before the outbreak of war, and we were in Grosvenor Square, the headquarters of the 2nd Battalion, and one of my very first duties, I remember, was to guard the tunnel at King's Cross Station against IRA attack. And subsequently, rather alarmingly, to be sent to Olympia to conduct a number of German roundup detainees to the proper camp in Yorkshire. I remember walking up and down the train counting them about every 3 minutes.
What type of men were they?
As far as I remember, seamen in the main. Merchant seamen and liner personnel. But I really have forgotten exactly.
What was their demeanour?
Entirely non-committal, submissive, if you like.
Did you hear the war declaration?
Yes, very well. I remember it in the officers' mess in Grosvenor Square.
How did everybody react?
I think, if I remember, slightly silently, and then Colonel Humphrey Butler, our commanding officer, pulled us together and rather along the lines of, now we'll all have a drink, that sort of thing. But no particular reaction one way or the other. One thing I do remember was, I think it was actually that day, or certainly the next day, that I spotted two American tourists photographing the installation of the barrage balloon in Grosvenor Square. And I stopped them. I now realise that that was exactly what I ought to have done, but at the time I just thought, I'm not too sure whether you should have done that.
Now, I know that in May 1940 Churchill sent the QVR and the 60th Rifles to Calais.
That's right, that was the 1st Battalion, and the whole lot of those who weren't killed were made prisoners of war.
What happened to you between...
Oh, I'd long since left them. In January 1940, Humphrey Butler, our commanding officer, I think largely due to the fact that he had been equerry to the Duke of Kent, and then through that was very much in touch with Howard Vyse, who was the head of the British military mission in Paris. And through that got wind of the development of what at that time was called Number 3 British Military and Air Mission, and that part of the development was to be a motorcycle platoon attached to a squadron of armoured cars as part of the reconnaissance and defensive ability of the mission. And he, through the back door, as it were, had persuaded the authorities that the motorcycle platoon should be found from the 2nd Battalion of the QVR. I think, frankly, it was a means by which he could put the battalion on the map. And he utilized his connections for that end. And I was chosen to command the platoon, I think principally because I was pretty well bilingual in French and English. And this number 3 British military and air mission was to be located at Valenciennes, which was in the French sector, and had the duty on any German invasion of advancing into Belgium and joining up with the Belgian army to conduct its affairs there. And of course, ridiculously, we were forbidden to cross the Belgian frontier until the Germans had actually invaded.
What kind of men did you have under you?
Absolutely first class. They were all expert motorcyclists, and to put it bluntly, of a pretty high social class. They were really not all that far off an octu. In fact, a considerable number of them became officers very rapidly in 1940-41, and the others stayed with Phantom to the end. But it was a very exceptional squad. They'd have admitted, you see, they'd all been volunteers in the early part of 1939. And had each come to an individual decision to join up. They were none of them conscripts.
Do you remember how the news came to you of the German attack on the 10th of May?
Extremely well, that we were woken up, and we'd been half expecting it, and we were woken up, and we simply put into action what we'd rehearsed many, many times at Valenciennes, and we were off across the Belgian frontier. I suppose it must have been about 8 o'clock, and I remember German reconnaissance planes very high in the sky making trails, which of course was something quite unusual at that time.
What do you remember about the reaction of the Belgian civilians?
Very friendly. Extremely, noticeably more so than happened 4 years later with the French population in liberated France in 1944. Very much so.
Where did you head for on the 10th of May?
Tongres, which was right up... not all that far from the Meuse, and when we arrived, the Germans were already shelling it. Not shelling it, bombing it. I suppose we must have got there at some time in the afternoon.
What did you do when you got there?
We barely arrived before we had to start going back, because the famous decision to hold the Albert Canal, which was part of the Belgian activity, was obviously not taking place at all, and the first 24 hours or so were pretty hectic because we were far too far forward, and really been having to retreat quite quickly.
What kind of equipment did you take with you?
We had Guy armoured cars for the squadron, and I've forgotten the make of motorcycle combinations, some of which had Bren guns mounted on them, and others were just ordinary motorcycle units. They were, in fact, extremely useful and, of course, operated in a far more professional manner by our German opposite numbers, who used motorcycle reconnaissance in a highly professional way. And I remember thinking that we really weren't in the same class in training as what we were up against.
Who were you supposed to make contact with once you got to Tom?
It was really the object of the entire mission was to enable the RAF to work close support bombing with reasonable accuracy in respect of the Belgian front. In fact, there was no Belgian front, so that the principal object of the mission was virtually a dead duck from the word go. What in fact we did was to turn ourselves into gathering information on almost any subject we were asked to, and it worked extremely well. One of the things that happened was that we were equipped with wireless, Morse code, of course, which was far more efficient than any other wireless operating in the Allied section, so that to a considerable degree, what we were able to, the answers to questions we were able to provide for various commanders was something which nobody else was within a mile of doing. And it so chanced that one of the commanders to whom we were most useful was General Allenbrook, who at that time was a corps commander. And in particular, I remember an occasion where we told him that, entirely contrary to what he thought was the case, the French on his right had retreated, and that his right was completely exposed. And to be honest, I don't think he ever forgot that. And that was one of the reasons why, after Dunkirk, he put the highest priority on the reforming of what had become to be called by then the GHQ reconnaissance unit, the code name of which was Phantom. And of course, Allenbrook remained a strong supporter of us throughout. But that was what originally turned him in our direction. Another instance of a totally different kind was Corporal Zeck, who was a brilliant Belgian electronics engineer who was part of our unit. He provided the only telephone line in between Sir Roger Keith with the Belgians and Churchill in London, completely off his own bat. So our activities really hadn't a great deal to do with what our original intention had been, but we succeeded in performing all sorts of different tasks as and when they were required in a situation of relative chaos.
Corporal Zeck was under you, was he?
No. Corporal Zeck was in the RAF part. He was an RAF corporal, which was with the Belgian headquarters. We weren't with the Belgian headquarters. We were more or less on our own, performing whatever task whoever asked us from time to time, including, for that matter, being part of Frank Force in an operating a fighting role for a bit when at a place called Wormhout, just this side of Dunkirk. So we right at the end, we stopped being reconnaissance or intelligence personnel at all and simply became straightforward fighting soldiers for a bit.
Wormhout has gone down in history as a place where there was a notorious massacre.
That's right.
Did you have any comments?
No, we'd been withdrawn by that time, luckily. But it can only have happened an hour or two after we'd left, because a small unit was pulled back by GHQ before the actual action started, which caused the trouble.
Did you personally take the message to Alan Brooke that the French had disappeared?
Well, you know, it's a strange thing, but I can't remember whether I did. But I was certainly right in it. I think probably not, but I forget now. But I knew all about it at the moment that it happened. But I don't think I took it personally.
How had you discovered that the French had gone?
By going and looking and finding nobody there. And that there was simply a gap.
So
the place was empty. And the Germans hadn't arrived, and the French weren't there either. And a number of our superiors were rather surprised when we said apart from some unfortunate barking dogs, I've forgotten which particular town it was, was empty.
Did you see any retreating French troops? Or were
oh, frequently. I mean, always, all the time. They were, and particularly, of course, the use of the dive bomber. The main serious result of which was not in fact the casualties inflicted on the refugees or on the retreating troops, but the absolute mayhem that it caused amongst the horses, because the great majority of the French supply echelons were horse-drawn, and the dive bomber, the thing was, the roads were a complete mess, mainly caused by panicked horses and, of course, refugees and retreating soldiery too. But the chaos was unbelievable, and in order to proceed at all, you had to make what use you could of fields on either side.
I've just been reading a book called The Myth of the Blitz by Angus Calder, who talks about the days of the British Expeditionary Force in France in May, June 1940, and seems to rely heavily on a book about Dunkirk by someone called Harman, in which he says that the French were eager to make a stand or counterattack against the Germans, but were let down by demoralised British forces.
Nonsense. This is a long time ago, and memory sometimes plays tricks, but that is totally untrue, at any rate from what we saw on a limited front. Some British troops were demoralised, no question about that, but they were more than offset by those who weren't, and in particular by remarkable characters like Colonel Lumsden of the 12th Lancers, who certainly on one occasion pulled some fairly demoralised British troops round by sheer personal example, which they got nothing to do with his command, nothing to do with the Lancers. I've forgotten which regiment they were there, but they were up a bit out of control.
Did you come across French troops?
Oh yes, frequently.
Who were anxious to make a counterattack?
Never. No. Whatever we did come across were plenty of French troops without any officers, and Belgians for that matter too. And I've no doubt that they, if they'd been organised, they would have joined in anything that was going, but they were leaderless. But one doesn't want to exaggerate that, because of course individual experience on a small front needn't necessarily have been the case elsewhere. But I've always thought that it was the French officers who were the cause of the trouble, and not the ordinary French soldier.
Your unit had to become riflemen at one stage.
Yes. Certainly. That was, I merely instanced that as we were sort of jack of all trades. But our principal objective was at that stage providing information. But in the end, with the chaotic situation at the end, we more or less turned our hands to anything we were asked to do. By far and away, the most important single action was unquestionably Zeck's provision of the link between Churchill and Sir Roger Keyes, which he did by, I wasn't there myself, but from what I was told, by simply his skill in rigging the Brussels telephone exchange.
What happened to you after Walmhout?
We went back to a place called La Panne, and got out from there after, of course, having to leave all our equipment and possessions behind.
These were the beaches.
That's right.
To the east of Dunkirk.
Yeah.
What was the scene on the beaches when you got there?
Varying. I don't remember a tremendous amount of enemy action. I remember a certain amount of air raids, and of course we were in the sea for quite a bit before we were eventually picked up. I was lucky enough to be taken on board HMS Worcester.
Another claim which is sometimes made about Dunkirk is that British officers let their men down at Dunkirk. Did you see anything
of
that?
No, certainly not. No. On the contrary, from what I've said about Colonel Lumsden, that was the line. Much more than. Again, it's difficult to be sure, because of course one only had a worm's eye view, but nothing that I saw indicated anything of that kind.
What was the actual procedure for you being taken off the beach?
I don't really remember, except that it was orderly. And the principal objective was to find something in which to get out to the rescuing craft, rather than simply swimming. And anything in the nature of a pedalo or something of that kind that could be found was property indeed, that you could turn into any form of raft or the ability to get off the shore.
What in the way of equipment was your unit able to take back?
Nothing. Simply what we stood up in, including personal possessions like my cigarette cases and things like that were all left behind. With personal packs and all that were all left.
And weaponry?
Yes, all of it.
Did the Royal Navy take you back? Or
very much so. And I remember, one thing I do remember was being, perhaps